Hello, this is Ed Reedy from the Talking Information Center with today's reading from Reuters. Iran war live updates. Trump says Iran could be taken out Tuesday night, but cites efforts to negotiate. By Zoe Law, Howard Goller, Jenna Zucker, and Alexander Villegas. What's happening? U.S. President Donald Trump says Iran could be taken out in one night. At 83-minute press conference, he says U.S. has an active willing partner in negotiations. Trump reiterates deadline, warns of Iran energy infrastructure ruin. He has extended the deadline from Monday to 8 p.m. Tuesday, midnight, GMT. Iran and the U.S. received a plan on Monday for an immediate ceasefire. U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth says Monday will bring the largest volume of strikes. Iran says it wants an end to the war, not a temporary ceasefire. Recap. Trump says Iran could be taken out in one night. Earlier on Monday, the U.S. president held an 83-minute press conference on Iran. Here's what he said. Trump warned that Iran could be taken out if it did not meet his Tuesday night deadline. The entire country can be taken out in one night, and that night might be tomorrow night, he said, referring to the 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time Tuesday midnight GMT deadline he set for Iran to meet U.S. demands or face the destruction of its national infrastructure. He said he needs a deal that's acceptable to me, and part of that deal is going to be we want free traffic of oil and everything. He vowed to destroy Iranian power plants and bridges, brushing off concerns that such actions would be a war crime or alienate Iran's 93 million people. But he said the U.S. has an active and willing partner to negotiations, adding that he hopes the U.S. doesn't have to bomb Iran's energy infrastructure. Trump and Hegseth praised the successful weekend retrieval from Iran of a U.S. airman whose jet was shot down on Friday. The U.S. president called the rescue mission a risky decision because the U.S. could have ended up with 100 dead as opposed to one or two. Hegseth, who has faced scrutiny for outspokenly blending his evangelical religious faith with military operations, described the rescue in explicitly Christian terms, comparing it to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Trump threatened to jail the person who reported on the mission while it was underway, saying it put the mission at great risk. Iran's official IRNA news agency has reported that Tehran rejected a ceasefire and said a permanent end of the war was necessary. Air New Zealand became the latest airline to slash flights and hike fares as the Iran war continues to raise jet fuel prices. The airline said jet fuel prices are more than double the usual, and its planned cuts in May and June would affect around 4% of flights. The surge in jet fuel prices has upended the global aviation industry. Delta Airlines said jet fuel prices increased by as much as $400 million in March and planned to pass on the costs through fare hikes. American Airlines reported a similar price increase in its first quarter expenses due to rising fuel costs, and Scandinavia's SAS said it was cutting flights due to the spike in fuel prices. Air France, KLM, also announced plans to increase long-haul ticket prices. Fuel is the airline industry's second-largest expense after labor, and the war has caused the industry's biggest crisis since the COVID pandemic. What G7 countries are doing to cap energy prices. The war has sent oil and energy prices around the world soaring, leading a number of countries to enact measures to try to contain the volatility. Here are measures some of the G7 countries have implemented. Germany, gas stations can only increase prices once per day at midday. Prices can be cut at any time. France, 70 million euros, $80.8 million in fuel subsidies for transport, farming, and fishing industries in April. 140 euro, $161 million benefit for low-income households to pay energy bills. United Kingdom, £53 million, $70 million package for homes using heating oil. Finance Minister Rachel Reeves says targeted support is under consideration. Japan, the government is using 800 billion yen, $5.01 billion of reserve funds to finance gasoline price subsidies. Finance Minister Satoshi Katayama said Japan is prepared to take necessary measures on all fronts. Iran's Joint Military Command calls Trump's threats delusional. Earlier, we reported on Trump's warning that Iran could be taken out if it did not meet his Tuesday night deadline to reach a deal. Now, we're getting some reaction from Iran. The rude, arrogant rhetoric and baseless threats of the delusional American president will not be able to compensate for America's disgrace and humiliation in the region. Ibrahim Zulfgarkari, spokesperson for the Unified Command of Iran's Armed Forces, Qatam al-Anib Central Headquarters said in a statement on state TV. U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran have killed senior officials, weakening the country's leadership as the wider war disrupts energy markets and global shipping. Some of the most prominent figures killed: Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who as supreme leader since 1989 built an iron grip over Iran while entrenching hostility toward the U.S. and Israel. He was killed at age 86 in a U.S.-Israeli airstrike on his compound on February 28th. Majid Kadami, the head of the Revolutionary Guards Intelligence Organization, was killed on Monday in an airstrike. Ali Larijani, Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council and a veteran power broker, was killed at age 67 in a U.S.-Israeli airstrike in the Pardis area on March 17th, along with his son and one of his deputies, Iranian media reported. Mohammad Pakpour, commander-in-chief of the IRGC, Iran's most powerful military force, was killed in the February 28 strikes in Tehran, Iranian state media said. Aziz Nazarzadeh, Iran's defense minister and a career Air Force officer, was killed in the same wave of strikes targeting senior leadership in Tehran on February 28th. According to sources, he played a key role in military planning and defense policy. Are attacks on civilian infrastructure war crimes? Trump has threatened to rain hell on Iran if it doesn't meet his Tuesday deadline. We have a plan because of the power of our military, where every bridge in Iran will be decimated by 12 o'clock tomorrow night, where every power plant in Iran will be out of business, burning, exploding, and never to be used again, Trump said during a press conference on Monday. But dozens of international law experts have said those sort of strikes could amount to war crimes. Our reporter, Anthony Deutsch, explains what the Geneva Convention says about attacks on civilian infrastructure and when they could constitute war crimes. The widening Iran conflict has led to airstrikes on infrastructure across the Middle East and threats to target oil facilities, electricity production sites, and desalination plants that supply civilians, which some experts say could amount to war crimes if carried out. What does international law say? The 1949 Geneva Conventions on Humanitarian Conduct in War prohibit attacks on sites considered essential for civilians. In no event shall action against these objects be taken, which may be expected to leave the civilian population with such inadequate food or water as to cause its starvation or force its movement. They explicitly prohibit attacks on objects indispensable to the survival of the civilian population, such as foodstuffs, agricultural areas for the production of foodstuffs, crops, livestock, drinking water installations, and supplies and irrigation works. Have there been warrants issued for attacks on infrastructure in other conflicts? The International Criminal Court cited attacks on critical infrastructure, such as electricity and fuel plants in Ukraine, in arrest warrants it issued for political and military leaders in Russia. In July 2024, the ICC accused Sergei Shoiga, the former Russian defense minister and leading Russian general, Valery Gerasimov, of war crimes for targeting Ukraine's power grid in the middle of winter. Russia has denied allegations of war crimes and says it launched a special military operation in Ukraine in February 2022 in self-defense. In the ICC's arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, judges considered that there are reasonable grounds to believe that both individuals intentionally and knowingly deprived the civilian population in Gaza of objects indispensable to their survival. Including food, water, and medicine and medical supplies, as well as fuel and electricity. The cutting off of electricity and reducing fuel supply had a severe impact on the availability of water in Gaza and the ability of hospitals to provide medical care, the judges found. The conditions resulted in the deaths of civilians, including children, due to malnutrition and dehydration, they said. Israel also denied war crimes allegations and says it has targeted militants in Gaza and Lebanon in self-defense against an existential threat. Could these be military targets? The Geneva Convention and additional protocols say the parties involved in military conflict must distinguish between civilian objects and military objectives, and that attacks on civilian objects are forbidden. The prohibition is also codified in the Rome Statute of the ICC, which is a court of last resort for 125 countries, but which does not include major powers such as Russia, the United States, and China. The Geneva Convention says some infrastructure owned and used by civilians can count as a military objective, but only objects which by their nature, location, purpose, or use make an effective contribution to military action, and whose destruction or capture offers a definite military advantage. Where could violations be prosecuted? A case on the current Middle East conflict is unlikely to end up in war crimes court anytime soon. None of the Gulf states, Israel or Iran, are members of the ICC. There is no other institution with clear jurisdiction over alleged war crimes in the region. Division within the UN Security Council, which can send cases to The Hague, means it is also unlikely that a case on the conflict is referred to the court. National authorities could collect evidence of alleged war crimes and prosecute them under so-called universal jurisdiction laws, but there are currently no public cases. Iran rejects ceasefire as Trump says entire country can be taken out. Dubai and Washington, Iran said on Monday it wanted a lasting end to the war with the U.S. and Israel and pushed back against pressure to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, while U.S. President Donald Trump warned the country could be taken out if it did not meet his Tuesday night deadline to reach a deal. Responding to a U.S. proposal through mediator Pakistan, Tehran rejected a ceasefire and said a permanent end to the war was necessary. The official IRNA news agency reported. The Iranian response consisted of 10 clauses, including an end to conflicts in the region, a protocol for safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz, lifting of sanctions, and reconstruction, the agency added. Trump, who has threatened to rain hell on Tehran if it did not make a deal by 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time Tuesday, to open the Strait of Hormuz, a vital route for global energy supplies, rejected the Iranian response and said his deadline was final. At a news conference, Trump said Iran could be taken out in one night, and that night might be tomorrow night, referring to Tuesday. He vowed to destroy Iranian power plants and bridges, brushing off concerns that such actions would be a war crime or alienate Iran's 93 million people. Without an agreement with Tehran, Trump said every bridge in Iran will be decimated by midnight Eastern Daylight Time on Wednesday, and every power plant in Iran will be out of business, burning, exploding, and never to be used again. Strikes on university. Iran's top joint military command in turn said Trump was delusional and called Trump's warnings rude, arrogant rhetoric and baseless threats, according to a statement by spokesperson Ibrahim Zulfghari on state TV. After Trump's latest comments, Iran's deputy sports minister, Alireza Rahimi, called on artists and athletes to form human chains at power plants across the country on Tuesday. "We will stand hand in hand to say attacking public infrastructure is a war crime," Rahimi said on X. Independent experts have also said strikes on civilian infrastructure, such as power plants and bridges, would constitute war crimes. Trump said Iranians are willing to suffer that in order to have freedom, and the U.S. has intercepted messages asking for bombings. After the U.S. and Israel attacked on February 28th, Iran effectively closed Hormuz, a conduit for about a fifth of the world's oil and natural gas supply. The waterway's stranglehold on the global economy has proved a powerful bargaining chip, and Tehran is reluctant to relinquish it too easily. The Pakistani brokered framework for ending the war proposed an immediate ceasefire, followed by talks on a broader peace settlement to be concluded within 15 to 20 days, a source aware of the proposal said. Iran also threatened to avenge a U.S.-Israeli attack early Monday on Sharif University of Technology in Tehran, one of the country's top science institutions, where Iran's WANA news agency said an artificial intelligence data center and other facilities were damaged. "Aggressors will see our might." In response to the Sharif bombing, Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said on X, "Iran's science minister has accused the United States and Israel of attacking some 30 universities in the war." Rescue mission. At the news conference, Trump and Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth praised the successful weekend retrieval from Iran of a U.S. airman whose jet was shot down on Friday. Hegseth, who has faced scrutiny for outspokenly blending his evangelical religious faith with military operations, described the rescue in explicitly Christian terms, comparing it to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The rescue mission came amid rising concern about the nearly 6 weeks long war's effect on the global economy, including a sharp rise in fuel prices. The conflict has also hit Trump's approval ratings and intensified anxiety among Republicans about November's midterm elections. Further aerial strikes were reported across the region on Monday. Hegseth said Monday would have the most strikes since the start of the war, and Tuesday would see even more. Iranian state media said the Revolutionary Guard's intelligence chief, Majid Kadimi, had died. Israel claimed responsibility for his death. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz threatened to destroy Iran's infrastructure and hunt down its leaders one by one. The Israeli military also said it had targeted Iran's air force through a series of strikes on Barim, Mehrabad, and Amaisha airports. Iran said two of its petrochemical complexes were attacked. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the strike on the petrochemical facility in southern Iran was part of dismantling Iran's Revolutionary Guard's money machine. Fighting back, Iran's attack on an Israeli-linked vessel and weekend strikes on petrochemical facilities in Kuwait, Bahrain, and the UAE underscored the country's ability to fight back despite Trump's repeated claims to have knocked out its missiles and drone capabilities. Israel saw a heavy day of rocket volleys on Monday, with the sounds of sirens and missile interception booms ringing out across the country throughout the day. Thousands of people have been killed across the Middle East in the Iran war, including 3,546 in Iran, U.S.-based rights group HRANA said, and nearly 1,500 in Lebanon. Israel has invaded southern Lebanon and struck Beirut in a fight against Iran-backed Hezbollah militants that has become the world's most violent spillover, the war's most violent spillover. 13 U.S. service members have died. How a perilous U.S. rescue mission in Iran nearly went off course, by Phil Stewart, Idris Ali, and Humeri Pamuk. Washington. The rescue had unfolded with near-perfect precision. Under cover of darkness, U.S. commandos slipped deep into Iran undetected, scaled a 7,000-foot ridge, and pulled a stranded American weapons specialist to safety, moving him toward a secret rendezvous point before dawn on Sunday. Then everything stopped. Two MC-130 aircraft that had ferried some of the roughly 100 special operations forces into rugged terrain south of Tehran suffered a mechanical failure and could not take off, a U.S. official told Reuters, speaking on condition of anonymity. Suddenly, elite commandos risked being stuck behind enemy lines. Their commanders made a high-risk decision, ordering additional aircraft to fly into Iran to extract the group in waves, a decision that left the elite commandos waiting for a couple of tense hours. If there was a holy shit moment, that was it, said the official, who credited quick decision-making with saving the day. The official, along with others who spoke to Reuters for this story, was granted anonymity in order to speak candidly about the operation. The gamble worked. The rescue force was pulled out in stages, and U.S. troops destroyed the disabled MC-130s and four additional helicopters inside Iran rather than risk leaving sensitive equipment behind. The Pentagon did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The successful extraction ended one of the most perilous episodes of the five-week-old conflict, averting what could have been a catastrophic loss of American lives and easing a mounting crisis for President Donald Trump as he weighs whether to escalate a war that has already killed thousands. Downed pilot Hid made contact. The rescued U.S. weapons specialist was the second of two crew members on an F-15E Strike Eagle fighter jet that Iran said on Friday had been hit by its air defenses. The U.S. official said the plane was flying over Isfahan province when it was brought down and the two airmen ejected separately. The pilot was rescued while the second airman remained in Iran. U.S. air crews are trained in survival, evasion, resistance, and escape, SEER techniques, if down behind enemy lines, but few are fluent in Persian and face a challenge in staying undetected while seeking rescue. A U.S. source familiar with some of the operational details said the American officer, who Trump said held the rank of colonel, sprained his ankle and hid in a crevice on a hilltop. The official said the airman later established contact with the U.S. military and authenticated himself, a critical step to ensure rescue forces were not walking into a trap. The CIA had run a deception campaign earlier, hoping to confuse Tehran by planting information inside Iran that U.S. forces had already located the missing airman and were moving him before the operation took place, a senior administration official said. But the U.S. military took additional steps, jamming electronics and bombing key roads around the location to prevent people from getting close. The U.S. source, familiar with the planning, said. The source told Reuters that the aircraft eventually sent to extract the airmen and rescue forces were much smaller turboprop aircraft capable of landing on small airfields and relatively light. Throughout the operation, the White House, the Pentagon, and the U.S. Military Central Command were uncharacteristically silent. Trump was so relatively quiet that a local reporter went to check if he was at Walter Reed Hospital. Once the mission was complete, Trump was triumphant. Over the past several hours, the United States military pulled off one of the most daring search and rescue operations in U.S. history, Trump said in a statement, adding that the airman was injured, but he'll be just fine. U.S. aircraft hit. The initial search effort encountered fierce resistance from Iran when it began on Friday after the F-15 pilot was initially rescued. Reuters reported on Friday that two Black Hawk helicopters involved in the search were hit by Iranian fire but escaped from Iranian airspace. In a separate incident, a pilot ejected from an A-10 Warthog fighter aircraft after it was hit over Kuwait and crashed, the official said, though the extent of crew injuries was unclear. The conflict has killed 13 U.S. military service members, with more than 300 wounded, the U.S. Central Command says. No U.S. troops have been taken prisoner by Iran. While Trump has repeatedly sought to portray the Iranian military as being in tatters, its ability to repeatedly hit U.S. aircraft is significant, military experts say. Iran's Qatam al-Anibia Joint Military Command said on Saturday the military used a new air defense system on Friday to target a U.S. fighter jet. Reuters first reported on U.S. intelligence showing that Iran retains of missile and drone capability. Until just over a week ago, the U.S. could only determine with certainty that it had destroyed about one-third of Iran's missile arsenal. The status of about another third was less clear, but bombings probably damaged, destroyed, or buried those missiles in underground tunnels and bunkers, Reuters sources said. Appearing unburdened after the successful rescue, Trump used harsh language on Sunday to threaten Tehran if it did not reopen the Strait of Hormuz for oil flows vital to the world economy. Artemis II moon mission breaks Apollo 13 record for distance from Earth. By Joey Roulette and Steve Gorman. Houston, the four astronauts of NASA's Artemis II mission cruised on Monday to the deepest point in space reached by any human, following the tug of lunar gravitational force en route to a rare crewed flyby over the shadowed far side of the moon. As the climactic six-hour flyby of Earth's only natural satellite got underway, some two dozen lunar scientists packed a room adjacent to mission control at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston to record the astronauts' first observations of the moon's surface in real time. The Artemis II crew, riding in their Ariane capsules since launching from Florida last week, began their sixth day of spaceflight. As they awoke at around 10:50 a.m. Eastern Time, to a pre-recorded message from the late NASA astronaut Jim Lovell, who flew aboard the Cold War-era Apollo 8 and Apollo 13 moon missions. "Welcome to my old neighborhood," said Lovell, who died late last year at age 97. "It's a historic day, and I know how busy you'll be, but don't forget to enjoy the view. Good luck and Godspeed." The four Artemis astronauts set a new spaceflight record on Monday as they exceeded the maximum 248,000-mile distance from Earth reached in 1970 by Apollo 13 after a nearly catastrophic spacecraft malfunction cut short that mission, forcing Lovell and two crewmates to use the moon's gravity to help return them safely to Earth. Later on Monday, the Artemis crew of U.S. astronauts Reid Wiseman, Victor Glover, and Christina Koch, and Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen were due to reach their own farthest distance from Earth, 252,755 miles, some 4,117 miles beyond the record held by the Apollo 13 crew for nearly 56 years. naming craters along the way, Artemis crew members spent some time assigning provisional new names to lunar features that previously lacked official designations. In a radio message to Mission Control in Houston, Hansen suggested one crater be dubbed Integrity after the name given to the crew's Orion capsule, and that another crater, sometimes visible from Earth on the cusp between the far and near sides of the moon, be named in honor of Wiseman's late wife, Carol, who died of cancer in 2020. A number of years ago, we started this journey, our close-knit astronaut family, and we lost a loved one, Hansen said of the mission commander's late spouse, his voice choking with emotion as he described the position of her lunar namesake. It's a bright spot on the moon, and we would like to call that Carol. As the Orion sailed around the moon's far side, the crew was expected witness its surface from as close as roughly 4,000 miles above its darkened surface as it eclipsed what would appear to be a basketball-sized Earth in the distant background. Because the moon rotates at the same speed as it revolves around the Earth, its far side always faces away from our planet, so that few human beings, only members of the Apollo crews who orbited the moon during their missions, have ever gazed directly on its surface. The milestone marked a major high point in the nearly 10-day Artemis II mission, the first crewed test flight of NASA's Artemis program, successor to NASA's 1960s and 1970s Apollo project, and the world's first voyage to send humans in the vicinity of the moon in more than half a century. Rare detailed photos, the planned multi-billion-dollar series of Artemis missions aims to return astronauts to the moon's surface by 2028 ahead of China and establish a long-term U.S. presence there over the next decade, building a moon base that would serve as a proving ground for a potential future missions to Mars. The last time astronauts walked on the moon, a feat so far achieved only by the United States, was the final Apollo mission in 1972. Monday's lunar flyby plunged the crew into darkness and a brief communications blackout as the moon blocked them from NASA's deep space network. A global array of massive radio communications antennas the agency has been using to talk to the crew. For the flyby, the astronauts were equipped with professional cameras to take detailed photos of the moon through Orion's window, showing a rare and scientifically valuable vantage point of sunlight filtering around its edges. The crew will also have the chance to photograph a rare moment in which their home planet, dwarfed by their record-breaking distance in space, will set and rise with the lunar horizon as they swing around, presenting a celestial remix of the moonrise typically seen from Earth. U.S. to raise Medicare Advantage payments to insurers by 2.48% in 2027. Insurance stocks surge, by Christy Santosh and Amina Niaz. The U.S. government said on Monday it would raise payments to private insurers offering Medicare Advantage plans to older adults in 2027 by 2.48% on average, an increase from the near-flat change it proposed in January, driving insurers' shares up sharply. A Medicare agency official said on a call with reporters that insurers would also get a 2.5% benefit from a change to risk assessment payments related to health status, for a total increase of about 5%. Shares of United Health, Humana, and CVS rose between 8 and 14% in extended trading as investors were relieved by the final proposal, a sharp contrast to the share declines after the government's January draft proposal for an increase of just 0.09% for 2027. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services said the increase would result in more than $13 billion in additional payments to Medicare Advantage plans in 2027. Julie Utterbuck, an analyst at Morningstar, said the payment rate was a relief for investors and provided insurers with a more favorable model for predicting medical costs in 2027. Change to risk assessments. Kevin Gade, chief operating officer at investment firm Beil & Gyner, said major health insurers would benefit from a pause on changes to the way the Medicare agency models risk for health insurers. The final rate number is actually closer to 3.5 to 4%, he estimated, when accounting for other changes in the payment methods. We'd call it a win. Medicare agency officials said pausing the risk policy change was designed to give both insurers and providers time to adjust to other longer-term structural payment changes. A CMS official noted that insurers had dropped some capitated plans that pay a set amount per member, which aimed to drive down costs, and that providers had left the Medicare Advantage networks. Health insurers had argued that the January proposal did not reflect the realities of rising medical costs. As health plans incorporate the policies released in recent days, they'll continue to focus on keeping coverage and care as affordable as possible during this time of sharply rising medical costs, said Chris Bond, a spokesperson for Health Insurance Trade Organization, AHIP. The U.S. government had set the final 2026 Medicare Advantage reimbursement rate at an average increase of 5.06% after initially proposing a 2.2% increase. Iran halts two Qatar LNG tankers it previously cleared to transit the Strait of Hormuz, sources say. Singapore. Iran's Revolutionary Guard halted two Qatar liquefied natural gas tankers that had been heading towards the Strait of Hormuz on Monday morning and instructed them to hold position without explanation, a source told Reuters on Monday. Iran had permitted the vessels to transit the strait under an agreement reached with the United States last week via Pakistani mediation, said the source who had been briefed on the agreement and spoke on condition of anonymity. This was part of an arrangement negotiated as part of talks spearheaded by Pakistan last week, the source said. Both ships were positioned off the coast of the United Arab Emirates on Monday evening and had not transited, Hormuz ship tracking data showed. Had the vessels successfully crossed the strait, they would have been the first transit of LNG cargoes through the waterway since the start of the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran on February 28th. The conflict, which began with U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran, has killed thousands and damaged economies by driving up oil prices. Tanker traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, a route that carries about a fifth of global oil and LNG flows, has been effectively closed by the fighting and retaliatory attacks. U.S. President Donald Trump said on March 26 that Iran had agreed to let 10 oil tankers transit the Strait of Hormuz as an apparent goodwill gesture in negotiations. They said, to show you the fact that we're real and solid and we're there, we're going to let you have 8 boats of oil, 8 boats, 8 big boats of oil, Trump said. I guess they were right and they were real, and I think they were Pakistani flagged. It ended up being 10 boats. Data from analysts firms Kepler and LSEG showed the two Qatari vessels, Al Dayan and Rashida, loaded their cargoes in late February. The vessels were loaded with LNG from Ras Laffan, Qatar. They had been moving eastward towards the strait, but turned back on Monday morning, ship tracking data showed. The two vessels changed course signals on Monday afternoon. The Aldayin began signaling Ras Laffan as its destination after previously indicating a destination of Pakistan, while the Rashida switched to signaling for orders, a generic placeholder, from Port Qasim in Pakistan. Earlier on Monday, the Aldayin had been signaling for China, the data showed. Kepler data showed both tankers as controlled by Qatari Energy. Qatari Energy did not immediately respond to a Reuters request for comment about Iran's Revolutionary Guards having stopped the ships. Previously, a Japanese LNG tanker, the Sohar LNG, managed to cross the strait. Its joint owner, Mitsui O.S.K. Line, said on Friday. The tanker, however, was empty, and a company spokesperson declined to disclose when the passage took place or whether any negotiations were involved. Qatar is the world's second-largest exporter of LNG, with shipments mostly going to buyers in Asia. Iranian attacks knocked out 17% of Qatar's LNG export capacity, with repairs expected to sideline 12.8 million tons per year of the fuel for 3 to 5 years. CBS to sell late-night hours to Byron Allen as Colbert Show ends. CBS said on Monday it was turning its 11:30 p.m. Eastern Time post-local news time slot into a time buy, selling it to Byron Allen after the end of Stephen Colbert's late-night program in May. Paramount Skydance will move Allen's comedy talk show, Comics Unleashed, to the slot under a time-buy agreement, with the series airing 2 back-to-back half-hour episodes nightly beginning May 22nd, the network said. A time-buy, a common practice in late-night and early morning hours, is when a network sells a specific block of airtime to an outside producer or company rather than filling that slot with its own programming. The agreement is for the 2026-2027 TV season and will take CBS from financially challenged to profitable in late night. Colbert's The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, a frequent platform of satire aimed at President Donald Trump, will end its 10-year run on CBS on May 21st. As part of the deal, Allen will also continue to lease the 12:37 a.m. hour with another strip from his company, the comedy game show named Funny You Should Ask. I truly appreciate CBS's confidence in me by picking up our 2-hour comedy block of Comics Unleashed and Funny You Should Ask, because the world can never have enough laughter, Allen said. The Late Show debuted in 1993 with David Letterman as the host after he was passed over by NBC's The Tonight Show. Colbert was a regular on The Daily Show before he hosted The Colbert Report on Comedy Central. He took over The Late Show in 2015. Good to be home. U.S. journalist Savannah Guthrie back on air after mother's abduction. New York U.S. television journalist Savannah Guthrie returned to her job as co-anchor of NBC's Today Show on Monday, more than 2 months after her 84-year-old mother vanished from her Arizona home in an unresolved kidnapping. At 7 a.m. in the show's Manhattan studio, Guthrie launched into the headlines. The U.S. war on Iran, the Artemis II astronauts traveling to the far side of the moon, before briefly acknowledging her absence. "We are so glad you started your week with us, and it is good to be home," Guthrie said. "Yes, it is good to have you back at home," her co-anchor Craig Melvin replied, patting Guthrie's hand. "Well, here we go. Ready or not, let's do the news," Guthrie said. She was last at the anchor desk in January, shortly before her mother, Nancy Guthrie, was taken from her home near Tucson. An armed man wearing a ski mask was recorded tampering with her doorbell camera before the disappearance. Savannah Guthrie and her siblings later recorded emotional pleas for their mother's return, offering a $1 million reward, but she has yet to be found. In a video she recorded in February, Guthrie said her family was blowing on the embers of hope that Nancy Guthrie was still alive, but acknowledged that she may already be gone. U.S. Democratic lawmakers visit Cuba, call on Trump to bring the rhetoric down, by Dave Sherwood. Havana, two Democrats from the U.S. House of Representatives visited Cuba last week, the first delegation to go to the island this year since U.S. President Donald Trump imposed a de facto oil blockade in a bid to bring Cuba's communist-run government to its knees. Congressional Representatives Pramila Jayapal, a leading member of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, and Jonathan Jackson, a Democrat with a long interest in Cuba, said they had come to see the suffering that is happening on the ground as a result of Trump's fuel embargo, which they called an illegal blockade of energy supplies. The lawmakers' visit comes at a time of unprecedented tensions in the decade-long, frosty relationship between the U.S. and Cuba. The Trump administration has closed the tap on remittances to Cuba, threatening to slap tariffs on countries that provide oil to the island, and placed it on a list of nations that sponsor terrorism. This is the most sanctioned part of planet Earth right now, just 90 miles off our shores, Jackson told a small group of reporters at a privately owned hostel near Havana's waterfront. Let's bring the rhetoric down. People are suffering, and they're suffering for no good reason. The lawmakers said their five-day trip, which ended on Sunday, included meetings with President Miguel Diaz-Canel, Cuban lawmakers, and top officials at Cuba's foreign ministry. Both nations have acknowledged they have begun talking, though few details of those discussions have been made public. There has been dialogue, the beginnings of dialogue, Jayapal said following meetings with top Cuban officials. I don't think it's reached the state of negotiation that we were told, but I think there is a desire to ensure that there is a real negotiation about what needs to happen in order for the situation to change. The lawmakers said they were saddened after visiting an oncology unit and a maternity ward in Havana hospitals that have been deteriorating for decades, but have been particularly hard hit by Trump's fuel blockade. Tough talk. Trump recently said he expected to have the honor of taking Cuba in some form and that I can do anything I want with the neighboring country. Despite such threats, Trump did not take action to stop a Russian tanker that last week delivered 700,000 barrels of desperately needed crude oil to Cuba. President Trump saw in his heart to let the Russian ship come in. Whatever changed his heart, we're grateful for, Jackson said. The Democratic lawmakers also praised Cuba for recent gestures of apparent goodwill. Cuba last month invited exiles to invest in businesses on the island, invited the FBI to investigate an illegal incursion by sea that left five dead off Cuba's north coast, and most recently said it would pardon upwards of 2,000 prisoners. There are a number of things that indicate that the moment is here for us to have a real negotiation between our two countries and to reverse failed U.S. policy of decades, a Cold War remnant that no longer serves the American people or the Cuban people, Jayapal said. She said Democrats would continue to push for bills that ensure the U.S. does not go to war with Cuba and would push to lift sanctions she said were ineffective. Jackson said the duo believed anything short of compromise would lead only to bigger problems. We can either help the Cuban people stay at home and live a healthy, normal life, or there's going to be a huge migration coming towards the United States, Jackson said. People will not simply stay here, suffer, and die. Chicago Sky trade Angel Reese to Atlanta Dream for two first-round picks. Chicago Sky have traded power forward Angel Reese to the Atlanta Dream in exchange for two first-round draft picks, the WNBA team said on Monday. Reese, 23, was chosen as the 7th overall pick in the 2024 WNBA draft and quickly became one of the league's standout names, earning acclaim alongside Indiana Fever sharpshooter Caitlin Clark. Reese led the league in rebounding during the 2024 and 2025 campaigns. The deal sees Atlanta acquire Reese in exchange for a first-round pick in both the 2027 and 2028 drafts, American media reported. The trade is designed to achieve roster balance and represents a great opportunity for all parties, Chicago General Manager Jeff Pagliuca said in a statement. Angel has achieved many record-breaking milestones in her first 2 years in the WNBA and has been a competitive force for the Sky. We're thankful for her many important contributions to this league and this game, and we know she will continue to have a big impact on the court and beyond. We wish Angel all the best in her next chapter. Chicago struggled during her 2 seasons, failing to qualify for the playoffs in both 2024 and 2025. The American, nicknamed Chi Barbie, reflected on her departure in a farewell video posted on social media. "To the city of Chicago, you showed me real love from day one," Reese said. "Thank you, Chicago. Always Chi-Town Barbie." McIlroy arrives at Augusta unburdened as Scheffler leads Masters odds, by Frank Ping. Augusta, Georgia. Rory McIlroy arrives at Augusta National Golf Club this week as the defending Masters champion and, for the first time in over a decade, free from relentless questions about when he will compete, when he will complete the career Grand Slam. Talk of McIlroy winning the Masters had become an April tradition in the golf world, but now the Northern Irishman will have a new sense of relief when he drives down the picturesque Magnolia Lane that leads to the Augusta National Clubhouse. "I'd like to start this press conference with a question myself," McIlroy asked with a smile shortly after his Masters triumph. "What are we all going to talk about next year?" McIlroy, who prior to 2025 had endured both heartbreak and close calls at the Masters, showcased his grit and talent last year when he overcame a topsy-turvy final round with a birdie at the first playoff hole to secure the breakthrough victory. Now, the 36-year-old McIlroy, the 6th man to complete the career Grand Slam, and whose best result this season has been a runner-up finish at Riviera, will try to pull off a rare Masters repeat. No player has won the Masters in consecutive years since Tiger Woods in 2001 and 2. Before that, only Nick Faldo, 1989 and 90, and Jack Nicklaus, 1965 and 66, have pulled off the Augusta double. Top-ranked Scheffler eyes third Masters title. World number one Scottie Scheffler, who is seeking a third green jacket in the last 5 years, has the shortest odds of any golfer in the field. Scheffler brought his career major tally to 4 with wins at the PGA Championship and British Open in 2025 and has never finished outside the top 20 in his 6 Masters starts. Scheffler, who romped to a 4-shot victory in his first event of the season, withdrew from his Masters tune-up event in Houston, a decision that was not injury-related, but rather due to the impending birth of his second child, who was born last week. Scheffler, who arrived at Augusta National on Sunday with his wife and 2 sons, last competed 3 weeks ago at the Players' Championship, where he finished in a share of 22nd place. With no players able to complete the career Grand Slam this week, the pressure will now shift to high-profile players still seeking an elusive green jacket. That group includes LIV Golf's Bryson DeChambeau, who briefly held the lead in the final round last year, Justin Rose, the man McIlroy beat in the playoff, and twice major winner Xander Schauffele. DeChambeau arrives at Augusta in top form. DeChambeau, a two-time U.S. Open champion who finished a Masters career best fifth last year, is in solid form, having won each of the last two LIV events in Singapore and South Africa. For DeChambeau, it was his short game that let him down at last year's Masters, and he will need to establish much better distance control with his irons if he hopes to become the first golfer to win a green jacket while competing for LIV. Rose, who has been enjoying a late career renaissance, carded a stunning 10 birdies in his final round 66 to reach the playoff with McIlroy in 2025 before becoming one of nine players to finish runner-up at least three times at Augusta National. The 45-year-old Englishman has 15 top 25 finishes in his 20 Masters starts, and earlier this year secured his 13th PGA Tour win with a wire-to-wire triumph at Torrey Pines. Woods to miss second consecutive Masters. Schauffele, who has finished inside the top 10 at Augusta National in five of the past 7 years, is a year removed from the rib injury that hampered his 2025 season and one of the more complete players in the game. Spaniard Jon Rahm, who collected his second major at the 2023 Masters before joining LIV 8 months later, will take like his chances given his form this year. Rahm, who had top 15 performances in three majors last year and represented Europe in his fourth Ryder Cup, has a win and three runner-up finishes on LIV this season and leads the circuit season-long individual standings. For a second consecutive year, five-time champion Woods will not compete at the Masters, as he announced last week he was stepping away to seek treatment after pleading not guilty in a driving under the influence arrest stemming from a rollover crash. And that's all the time we have for today. Stay safe, and thank you for listening.